Okay.
This could be K or L. It doesn't matter which you put there because they have to be the same. But you need the three chronicers to stay running. You know, A is restricted to that K. B is restricted to that K for L.
So, okay.
These are the matrices that I made for doing K2. And getting SU, because I had SU3 in there.
SU3. You don't want matrices.
So I made some that were SU3. Mm-hmm. And that was exactly what they were.
I've used these to build supersymmetry groups, too. You can build anything out of chronicles.
Right.
So since you're always building things with simple symmetry, you know, symmetry, anti-symmetry, Hermitian, anti-Hermitian, whatever, you can come up with a nice tidy basis for that by taking Kronecker stuff. And you can work with this, because you multiply two of these, you're summing over an A or B, you know, multiplying by something and summing over one of those indices generally. You take a linear combination of these, you know, to get a general element of the algebra, you're going to have a linear combination, you know, in the other two as well. So, you know, that is group
element. So does it matter that there's two K's and two L's in the classroom?
Does it matter which?
Does it matter that there's two K's and two L's in the last term?
No, because they're not summed.
Okay.
Right, they're fixed.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a label on here, so we're looking at, you know, we're looking at G 3-5. So, you know, think of those as 3 and 5, respectively.
Okay.
See what you get.
Okay.
Yeah. Only we're trying to label them all at once. But each generator, you've got some fixed number in each of those positions, but it's still a matrix. Everybody, does that help? Okay. Good. So we define these generators. Continue with the review. So this is a fix. I think we're agreed on that. So this was the same thing, but if you want a minus sign here, you don't need the diagonal terms as it's anti-symmetric. And there's an overall I to make it. And then the diagonal ones are the ones we were talking about before. So these give a basis for generators. You find the Lie algebra, and cumulatively, I'm just going to call these GA, and GA with GD, we're going to get some numbers, some structure constants, but let's just call them CA, D, C for the moment. With a GC. Now, let me introduce a convention. So G dagger equals minus. So let's see. These are actually Hermitian. So I want a 1/i there. The true generators of SUN are anti-Hermitian. So these guys are anti-Hermitian. These are real. Then let's, I don't know if I did this last time, but let's let HA times I over 2 times just the convenience constant G. That's going to be the field strength, actually. That's the most important measurable constant. Let this be GA, where now this H, because of this I, this H is Hermitian. And so 1/2 G times H is what we've got here. I mean, we can normalize those things any way we want, but I'm going to use these notational conventions when we get to SU2 and SU3. We're going to want a field strength, a coupling constant, and making that I explicitly will be be helpful. So then the commutation relations for the H's. We'll take to be some different numbers, and I think the convention I introduced was with an I here. There probably should be, right? If I multiply by I squared here and I squared here, then I call I G an H, and I call another I G an H, and I call one of the I G an H here, then I have one I left over. So I'm going to have an I explicit on the right hand side with these generators. And then the only other difference between F and C is this G over 2 factor. There's this G over 2 somewhere. You can figure out what the relation between F and C is. Exercise. I'm sprinkling these notes with exercises, as many as you can, some are longer than others, when something occurs to me to be something you could go compute, and just put it in, and use those as you teach it. Okay, now, so we get the Lie algebra, we write the Maurer-Cartan equation, so we introduce dual one-forms, and the Maurer-Cartan equations were the usual thing for Poincaré. And here I introduce what did I call these G's, little G's. A is let's see, what's the constant here? Right, if these are duals of the big G, then we have minus a half C, B, C, A, C, B, G, C. We could write this in terms of, we could introduce some lowercase h's and do it that way. That's not the way I've used lowercase h in the notes, by the way. There's a section I wrote on covariant derivatives that is just for a general Lie group, and I've called the connection one form lowercase h there, which is not what I used in the previous or later sections. Oh, watch out for that. And there's a comment about that in the notes, but I think it'll be clear. Then we generalize. The connection to omega and E F G. And that leads us to the Cartan equation. We're going to introduce curvature two forms, torsion two forms, and field strength. They're all curvatures of a bundle, but we get these two forms. And then restrict to RAB equals zero, TAB, or TA equals zero, and we show that in that case we can choose Cartesian coordinates with the spin connection zero and EA being DXA. And I think after that I might have changed the space-time index to alpha degree, but we're in just Minkowski space at that point. With Cartesian coordinates. All right, so we did all that. That's all written up. Does anybody have any questions on all of that? We ran through it, I think, in fair detail at a time. So what we end up with is these field strengths. Now we calculated the components of these. Okay, so now let's let alpha, beta be space-time. Let's let A equal 1 up to what's A run to? N squared minus 1. Runs to N squared minus, it's the number of generators.
Okay.
Right. Capital A runs over all the generators. So this is, SU2 has N squared minus, or SUN has N squared minus 1 generators. We checked that last time. Then I'm going to introduce lowercase, I'm going to be using 1 through N. Now, what has indices 1 through N? Where do we have an n-dimensional space? Everybody's working on different directions.
It's a representation. It's the vector space that FUN acts on. So we're writing n by n matrices for the FUN group elements and for the FUN generators that they act on an n-dimensional vector space. And that will be an index for those vectors. Okay, so that defines the representation. The field string we found the alpha of what do we call these? Are these still G's? Lie algebra valued one form. The algebra valued one point. Then we have, what was it? Well, pi over 2, g, this depends on the basis. This is a general discussion. We won't worry about those i's yet. So, structure constants, and then we'll have a g, b, alpha, g, c, beta. We noticed that the structure constants are always anti-symmetric on the first two indices, so this expression is anti-symmetric in alpha beta, just like the other terms of the field strength. So this is the Yang-Mills field strength in this real structure constant basis. So if I wrote that with an F, there'd be an I over 2 G. With that, probably something like that, or something. There'd be an I anyway, something on. Okay. Now, we wrote an action and I don't know if I remember to put the quarter in here, but it's nice with a quarter. And let me explicitly put all the metrics, all of the inner products that are happening. So, we have the killing metric, KAB. We have two copies of the inverse space-time metric. And then FA, alpha beta, FBU, nu. Well, then we can add a huge number of possible fields, but we're just going to add the simplest. We're going to take a multiplet of spinner fields. So we have Dirac spinners, ordinary space-time Dirac spinners, but we have n of them. And I bar, I, now we need a covariant derivative, d slash minus m, and a psi b, and we're going to need, let me call it delta a b, is the inner product on the representation vector space. So we've got three different metrics here. We have three different spaces we're talking about. They all happen to be vector spaces, we're not curving anything. Let's identify those. A group element or a generator, we have GA, right, our generators AB, right? So this acts on vector spaces BB to give this would be something like a change in Z. under a, an infinitesimal gauge transformation, right, you'd have something like this. Okay, so the group acts on this vector space. Well, it also acts on this vector space. We can take that vector space complex. So we have an n-dimensional complex vector space where each complex number in the component is actually a space-time spinner. So this one's got two indices, but I am out of an alphabet. So phi b is actually a collection, phi 1, phi 2, phi n, where each phi is equal to alpha, beta, mu, nu, a four-component Dirac spinner. And I won't try to introduce a label for those components.
That's just the transformed V?
Oh, yeah. For an infinitesimal...
Okay. Not a very deep.
G element of SUN, we have G is about equal to the identity plus F1A GA GB. So when that acts on a vector, the change in the vector is just going to be this,
oh,
this,
right,
this part
right,
here.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, everybody see what I'm doing there?
Yeah,
yeah, this is what I meant by my
okay.
Assuming we're on the page. Make me fuzzy think. If it's not transparent what I'm saying, just say, whoa, stop. Fill it in. All right. A lot of things going on. We need to know... this K and this delta. All right. Delta AB is the Hermitian metric preserved by SUN. Now, I suppose back in the beginning, maybe I'll stick this into the notes. I should have defined SUN. Right? We know what it is, but what is it? It's a set of unit determinant matrices that preserve a Hermitian metric on an n-dimensional vector space. So that's the Hermitian metric. Well, this is trivial because the unitary, you can diagonalize it with a unitary transformation, so you might as well take it to be the identity. You have an inner product on these V's. You know, a V with a W is delta AB, VA, WB. You've got that kind of inner product. And the norm of every vector V is preserved by the SUN transformation.
So you're saying, like, do an SUN transformation on V, another one on W, and then...
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, one comes in with a dagger, and so you find that U dagger U's got to be one. Yeah, the invariance really gives you that U dagger, you know, you've got the V dagger over here, you've got the delta, the metric, whatever that is here, you've got a U here, and you've got W there, has to be equal to V dagger delta W. And so what has to happen is that U dagger delta U has to be delta. And you diagonalize delta to an identity, and then it's the usual condition for a unitary transformation. Notice that these Vs should be complex because you want unitary, not orthogonal. You really want the complex case here. But what we're really interested in are these spinners. They're complex. So we want a unitary inner product. Okay. K is a Killing metric of S-U-N. You can take it to be the trace of a product of two generators. It's also equal to some multiple, I'm not sure which, of a contracted set of structure constants. Not hard to show those relationships. Not hard to show that for our case, this is let's call it half this,
yeah.
And then it's just Kronecker. I think one of the problems I gave was to show that, and for the basis we chose, it's easy. Those things that square something with trace two, and the trace of the product of two different ones will be zero. So that's not hard to demonstrate. So actually, all the metrics around are Kronecker's. They're all identity matrices except the space-time one that has a funny minus sign in it. So it's actually easy. That means that it doesn't actually matter what position we put the indices in. So often you'll see this written without the Kelly metric. They'll just write F A F A. Right, sum over the A. The implicit assumption is A is unitary, the metric is the identity. So, with that, all of this input, we can write F a little more simply as a quarter F A alpha beta. We can raise these indices, set those two the same. So we can write the first term like this, and then we can suppress the multiplet index for these vectors, remembering that you have a bunch of these things. You could write sometimes something as simple as this, remembering that you have a whole bunch of these that have to be added over. So you're summing over the group here, or we could write a let's do it that way so that we don't lose track of having a multiplet there. Any questions so far? Any more questions?
It's over D4X, right? Again. Yeah, over
D4X, D4. Yeah. Yeah, I'll stick it up here. Yeah, we're over space-time here. Okay, the one thing I haven't expanded is that covariant derivative. And the covariant derivative is built with the gauge field and the structure constant. And just squeeze it in over here. So D of... All right, we're really talking about a vector here. Right? This D is covariant with respect to FUN transformation. So the covariant derivative is going to be partial. Okay, we're differentiating on the manifold, but different places on the manifold may have a different FUN gauge, right, up or down the fiber. So to correct for that, we have a term, there will be a, let me think now, Lie algebra value 1 forms, what are our connections? So we have a connection, G, and G is a Lie algebra valued 1 form. So let's go ahead and expand it into Lie algebra. And that tells us how the covariant derivative acts on the spinners. So we need those group elements, group generators in there to know how to correct the spinner. So that's what the covariant group is.
G is a group element.
G is
a group element.
Little G is the connection.
Oh, right.
It's the.
Okay. Right. Yeah.
The one form. You can of course write that as a one form equation. Just don't write the indices. G psi is.
Little
D, yeah. D, you know, you can suppress as many of these indices as you like. You know, I could call this G alpha if I like, and, you know, hide all of these indices. You can get really cryptic about, oops, but that becomes a one form, so there are no indices at all. And you can, in a nutshell, you'll see, I do some calculations like that, as an exercise, as you put the indices in. You know, it's nice to be able to go back and forth. You can prove covariance, you know, from that form of the thing. And everything works fine, in fact. Yeah?
Why are there as many spinners as there are degrees of freedom in the FUN field? N is the number of fields we have.
Not gauge fields. We have far more gauge fields. We have N squared minus 1 gauge fields.
Okay.
All right. But those gauge fields are, you know, Lie algebra valued one forms, where the Lie algebra acts on some n-dimensional vector space. So multiplex. So SU2 acts on doublets, right? Up and down quark, right? Electron, neutrino. Those pairs are SU2 doublets. Well, SU2 we represent as 2x2 matrices. There are 3 generators, n squared minus 1. But it acts on a two-dimensional space, so we put our spinner fields, our up spinner and our down spinner, in pairs. So that A runs from 1 to 2. You know, we're not going to be doing big applications with this, you know, SU27 or something. You know, just SU3 is not so hard to be explicit about. So we expect our quark spinners under the strong interaction to come in triplets of spinners. And the first in the triplet is the red spinner, and the second is the blue spinner, and the third is the green spinner. And so, you know, all of the spinner fields we write for the quarks are going to be in that kind of triplet.
So U1 is only one spinner?
Yeah. U1, so, yeah, we've seen this for ENM, but we only had one of these guys.
Right.
We only needed one. UN, right, abelian group. The field strength doesn't have these commutator terms because the generators are used with itself, and we just have that curl, so it becomes simpler in that case. In my notes, I've treated this case with the abelian group as well. Like for the covariant derivative, it's a little bit different. It's not very different. I wrote out that case too, so you can check what happens there.
So, each spinner has 4.
These 4 components. Alright. How many components does a spinner have in basic dimension? Alright. So take the 6-dimensional Lorentz group. And, you know, so 051. So you want spin 51, the spin group for some 6-dimensional Minkowski space.
2 to the n.
Right, spinners, it's 2 to the n over 2 components. Now, in order to build that Clifford algebra of gamma matrices, you need the dimension to be 2 to the n over 2. Well, 2 to the 6 over 2 is 8. So spinners in 6-dimensional Minkowski space have 8 components. It's just a coincidence that this has 4, that is not a space-time vector. That's 2 to the 4 over 2, and you happen to be able to write the Dirac matrices in a 4-dimensional representation in 4 dimensions. It's an unfortunate coincidence. You know, it causes a lot of confusion.
So
the difference.
So that was my other next question, where we go to Flash is the same gamut.
Yeah, Flash is our usual Flash. You know, this is the ordinary Dirac equation along with, you know, a little other stuff. So yeah, the space time stuff going on here is totally standard. Okay, but yeah, you do have to you know, we really are dealing with three different vector spaces here at the same time, and it's confusing. And wait till we get to the weekend section. They'll all be left-handed. I was going to talk about other things that might be in the action but aren't, just to convey a little bit of the idea of, you know, what things could count as tensors here. This may help you get a grip on the different vector spaces we're dealing with all at once, and the big group we've got. You know, we've got a big group here, this product thing. Let's take a look. We got this board one?
Yeah.
Thanks. If you get bored and want me to move faster, just say. You know, I'm thinking it doesn't hurt to do a bit of review each time and show you things again. Reading, you know, there's probably some books out there to read too. I'll take a look at some and see if I can't find some good references. I mentioned the Wikipedia articles on this. You know, very condensed, but you know, there are tables of the different particles and things like that. The Wikipedia article on standard model is fairly comprehensive and written by some people who are quite familiar with it. Some of the other articles you'll just find little blurbs. You know, they're just, what do they call them? Stubs.
Stubs.
Yeah. They're a little more than stubs. I mean, they say some stuff, but they don't really do much elaborate. At this point, you know, flipping back and forth, you know, looking at like 10 different Wikipedia pages just to check. They are, the one on the standard model is up to date. There's a better resource for getting numbers, but they use it. The numbers match exactly with the particle data group. And you should check that site. Just Google it, they've got an extensive site. They have all of the latest data on every aspect of the standard model. You know, you can look up like the last 6 months' results on the value of the strong coupling constant. You know, it's the strong coupling constant. You know, the thing like alpha, but for the strong force, it's 1.198 plus or minus. I forget the error, but it's pretty close to 0.12. But it's known to, you know, really, you know, to the fourth decimal place, you know, plus or minus some stuff there. But, you know, there are very careful measurements of all of the parameters that we're going to talk about. And there are a lot of parameters in the standard model. You know, you've got a whole bunch of quarks, but then the way they couple to, say, the W particles involves a 3x3 unitary matrix, the Kobayashi-Maskawa, the Kobayashi-Maskawa matrix. Kobibo invented it, and Kobayashi and Maskawa got the Nobel Prize for it. Kobibo had no comment. End quote. That was unfair. You know, Kobibo did it 2x2, and these guys blew it up to 3x3 to handle more generations of quarks that weren't around when Kobibo did this 50 years ago. But, you know, the Kobibo angle is well known, and, you know, he certainly should have shared some measure of acknowledgement for that work, I think. But what do I know? I'm getting ahead of the story because
that has to do with weak interaction. The tensors that I wanted to talk about, okay, we've introduced several. Of course, we have the usual space-time tensors. We've got the metric, we've got the Levy-Civita tensor, of course, Kronecker delta, inverse metric, and so on. Not a lot more, because it's flat space, and those are the only two invariant tensors, so it's pretty simple. But then we also have representations. You know, we could introduce some vector fields or tensor fields, you know, if we wanted to. Now we don't have any natural ones except for the one we've got. You know, we have the field strength, and you know, this is of course the one that the whole gate theory is about. This is the one that gives rise. This is the kinetic term and the interaction term because of this for the gauge particles. Well, the gauge particles are the W and Z and the gluon and the photon and the graviton. We're not doing it yet. We'll get there. Alright, so these are the particles that bind. And so those are certainly going to be important to include in our action. Then the particles that constitute matter are all fermions. Alright, the particles that convey forces are all gauge bosons. Spin 1 or possibly spin 2. There's the Higgs particle conjectured to give rise to masses, that's a scalar. But then the particles of matter, the quarks and the leptons, are all spinner fields. So we're going to need spinner fields. And these are the ones we've included in our basic picture here. We want to put them in multiplex. And so both of these have dual roles. Okay, this is acted on, you know, this gives rise to a space-time thing that is a linear combination of the generators. This is a Lie algebra value 2 form, if you want to write it that way. So, this object has either one Lie algebra index or a pair of vector representation indices like this. You can write it either way. So you could call this thing an F A B alpha beta. That's what's happening with the Lorentz group, where our labels for the group end up being a pair of space time indices. So this ends up looking like the Riemann curvature tensor. But the first two indices are group indices of some sort, either a pair from the vector space or one from the generators. These things, of course, have one index in that space. So this is a rank 2 tensor under SU2. It's a rank 2 tensor under the Lorentz group. So write that down. Rank 2 Lorentz. That's the alpha beta indice, and it's rank 2 under FUN. Right. In the vector representation, right, the rank of a tensor is the number of these lowercase Latin indices. So that's the AB. Alright, this spinner field is right, it's a Lorentz spinner. It's an FUN vector. Right, one spinner index, one FUN vector index. And so each of these things has transformation properties. If you do a Lorentz transformation, okay, there's a certain way they transform. If you do an FUN transformation, you know, this affects the other instead of into V. Well, we can build all kinds of things like this. In general, you know, suppose we take a simple spinner, right? Yeah, what would this be if I had just a single spinner? What would that be called? It's still a Lorentz spinner. What is it under SUN? I heard it. That's right. Taylor? Who said that? Good job. It's an SUN scalar. It doesn't transform under SUN, has no SUN indices. But we still have to specify how it behaves. It behaves as a scalar. Okay, so now take a spinner like that and construct something like psi bar gamma alpha psi. What kind of an object is that?
Lorentz vector? Right, no.
That's a Lorentz vector. Yeah. Yeah, we could call it like V alpha, right? And this is just this single SUN scalar. We haven't put in any new SUN indices, so it's still an SUN scalar. Well, there are a bunch of these we can write. I think we wrote them down last time. We could just write psi bar psi. What is that?
Still a scalar, very well, sort of.
Nothing sort of. Nothing sort of. It really is. It's a scalar scalar. Right? It's a Lorentz scalar and an SUN scalar. The complete list of these, we have the identity we can stick in here. We can stick in the gamma matrices. We can stick in the sigma matrices. And these are all well-defined Lorentz tensors, so these are definitely worth considering. We can put in gamma alpha, gamma phi, or we can put in just gamma phi. And this is the scalar. These are all SUN scalars. But this is the Lorentz scalar. This is the Lorentz vector. This is a Lorentz tensor. This is a Lorentz. And we said this last time. What was it?
Pseudo
vector. Good. And the last one.
Lorentz pseudo scalar.
Pseudo scalar. Good.
Why the pseudo again? Sorry.
Because it has the long behavior under parity. Okay, gamma 5 contains the Levy-Civita tensor. The Levy-Civita tensor coming in odd numbers always mucks up the parity. It throws the opposite sign into the parity because your space inversion is compensated by inverting those three spatial bits on the Levy-Civita. So, for example, while the coordinate vector x and the momentum vector p are both normal vectors, angular momentum r cross p, x cross p, is a pseudo vector. X goes to minus x under parity, p goes to minus p, but l goes to l. Right, so you get the wrong sign. You've got an epsilon ijk in there because of the cross product. And that is a general pattern. If you have a Levy-Civita tensor, it changes the parity from what you would expect for that kind of object.
If we put our SUN in the indices on here, then they're all tensors.
Exactly. Okay, so let's try that. So how do you want to do it?
So let's take the Lorentz scalar and let's put an index on here. Put another index from them. Now what do we got?
Maybe a
scalar. It's still a scalar.
Yeah, right.
But make them different. Now it's an SUM second rank tensor. And the Lorentz scalar. And of course the combinations are endless, right? You can build any kind of thing at all here. We could take our product of say multiplet from chi the build a rank n tensor under SU2 by taking these outer products, and then what we do with the Lorentz stuff, well, now that could be an outer product of n spinners too, k spinners, and so then it would be a rank k tensor under spin. It would have spin k over 2 because each spinner has spin 1/2, so it would transform with k copies of e to the I phi over 2, n dot sigma or something. Right. Or some variant of that.
So are we doing an outer product here? No.
Yeah, something like this with an outer product.
Okay.
Just multiply.
Okay.
Yeah, and, just leave all the indices free and you're just building higher and higher rank tensors. So, I probably don't need to do more examples. I think you guys have got it, right? So you basically just index counting. You count up all the spinner indices. If you've got k spinner indices, then you've got a rank k spin tensor under the Lorentz group, and it's going to have spin k over 2. If you multiply k different SUN indices, you've got a rank n tensor under SUN. And it can have any mix of those different properties. And you could use those properties then to form invariants, scalars. Anything that is an SUN scalar and a Lorentz scalar can go in the action. Right? And, we checked here, and, all the indices are summed. There are no free indices. So that's a scalar on both counts. Good. They can go in the action. So there are lots of things you could put in the action, but you'd be crazy to come up with these things, unless you were really forced to it by some physical consideration, and we haven't been yet, because this action works perfectly well for the standard model, and the standard model, as we know, explains everything.
Everything's measurable. Dark matter and dark energy.
Yeah, Wimps are good candidates.
Who came up with that?
And the dark energy is the, probably just a cosmological constant. Right. So, these things may not be, terrible puzzles, in fact. But what was the question? Who came up with what?
What's that term name? Standard model. Who put it all together, finally?
The standard model emerged in the early 70s, I would say.
There's someone...
I don't know who coined the term. It's common to call, the current thing that works for the standard model. General relativity is the standard model of gravity, for example. Not the only model of gravity, but as far as the best one we've got, it has stood up to all tests, and so, that's the thing against which everything else has to compare itself and, either make or break the theory. That's the one that you try the hardest to test, and, I don't know. They come and go. A century ago, neither the standard model nor general relativity was around, and something else was the standard model. Newtonian physics, I guess, or Hamiltonian dynamics, or, something like that with Maxwell, would be the standard model. But this one has always been called the standard model, and it has been
long as I can remember. So, you know, getting longer and longer all the time. I would say probably in the early 70s, people started seeing that as a satisfactory picture of all of the data that emerged in the 60s and started referring to it as the standard model. You know, sometimes 20 people think it's a good idea all at once, you know, and maybe everybody, you know, in, you know, 16 different countries, you know, 28 different people all simultaneously said, let's just call this the standard model. I don't know. I have no idea where it came from. We can find out. Let's find out. There's a lot of independent discoveries. All right. Now, I wanted to talk a bit about the covariant derivative. So, where? What board?
I think it's actually. Yeah.
So we said that d alpha of a spinner field is a partial derivative of the spinner field. And then we had a gauge field, d alpha, and then a generator, or the set of generators, and their matrix representation acting on that SUN vector. And see, we defined another set of generators. We said that we wanted to be able to let G be equal to I over 2 little constant G times some generators H. So we could also write this that way. D alpha psi A is partial alpha psi A plus I over 2 G times the generators, the gauge field summed on the generators expressed in the basis acting on the spinner like that. I think that's the normalization that is in the notes, but I'm choosing the notation there to agree with standard usage, and then struggling to get the science to work out right. Eventually they do. Now, why is this thing the covariant derivative? I think we've done this a bit before, but in general, let's review just what we have for general Lie algebras. So any Lie algebra let's make it a simple Lie algebra. Let's take a linear representation, just to keep it simple and linear. Then we have generators, we can continue to call those G. We have structure constant C. So the Lie algebra looks like that. And we have dual one forms. We have GA, and let me call them one forms H, B, to give a conjugate of B, A. Then the linear representation is implied by some vector space that you act on. So we have some vector space containing vectors B, A,
that defines the size of the linear representation, the size of the matrices that we're going to write G in terms of generated. So the covariant exterior derivative of one of those vectors is simply the exterior derivative of the vector plus the connection H acting on the A component of that. Or, once again, in the ultimately cryptic version,
TP plus HB. You know, if you've introduced a basis for this vector space and sum these on the basis, you know, you can write them that way.
Well,
that's fun, but not necessarily totally clear. Let me expand this, and maybe I'll, we'll see how many indices we put in when we prove things. So, what does this mean? We are taking a space-time derivative of these components. So what we really have a vector field over space-time. And then, so we can take a normal derivative with respect to the dependence of these on that base manifold. Then the H is a Lie algebra value one form. So the one form gives the space-time index. It's Lie algebra valued, so really we expand it in our basis for the Lie algebra, which are these generators G. Each of those generators G is a matrix that knows how to act on that vector space V. So we get a complete expression this way with all of the indices explicit. And, you know, it does get a little cumbersome to work with all those symbols, so you condense things a bit in the parts of the system that you're not using at the moment. Now, we want to prove a few things about this. We need to show two things. B is a derivation, which involves two things. Anybody remember?
Leibniz and...
What's the other?
Linear.
Yep. Linear Leibniz. Good. Okay. And what else do we want to show?
Right. Not contravariant.
Actually not. In
streets of being contrary.
In other instances,
yeah.
I've seen this written generally, I've seen covariant derivatives written generally with respect to Lie with a with structure constants instead of the...
You can use an adjoint representation.
Okay, which is G is...
And that is... You know, I've done that. Maybe I showed you. Let me make a note of that. Maybe a good exercise would be to carry this all out in the adjoint representation. But adjoint rep. All right, what happens there is the adjoint representation is one where GA, the DC component, is the structure constant. Okay, so first problem, prove that that is a representation of the algebra. Okay. Well, if you write the commutators of these, you'll find that
right? Or you know, write the commutators in terms of these things, and you'll find you've written the Jacobi identity. So, you know, by virtue of the Jacobi identity, the commutators of these things actually are the Lie algebra. It works just right. Let's try it. Now, what happens is the action of the group on one of these things if we have a vector v in the Lie algebra, so we expand v in the generator. What kind of tensor is that? What kind of object is G? What are the free indices if I put them all in?
Entire group, right? No.
Yeah, so these guys are actually Z's. I'm summing on A, so I have the CV free here. So I have two the algebra indices free. And it's a second rank tensor under the action of these guys. So this is the second rank. So up here, so V prime here is a group element times V, where G is an element of our lead group. But here, V prime is GVG inverse. You need a double-sided transformation, and one's up and one's down. Now, the proof of all these things goes through, but the covariant derivative now is defined as V of V is still the exterior derivative, but now you take a commutator. What did I call the generators? The agent, yeah. So now you define this. So prove all this. Good exercise.
I have another question.
Yeah.
I think this like in January, I think, or something. Is it the same thing for the covariant derivative? I mean, or. Let's see. I've used this in the past, but
that's the linear one. That's the linear. Yeah.
Okay. So, because here you have like an H with a generator, but isn't it just the H then right here?
Wait a minute. Let's see.
Ooh. So you check this.
Because this omega's got.
Yeah. I was trying to find a one of like SO42. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. No, that's right, but let's, which one is it? Let's see, I have to think about that a second.
Here's what I ended up with at the very end.
You would need two omegas for a second rank.
Right, yeah, so.
Yeah.
For the conformal group, yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, I remember looking at this, and you know, everything was working out right. So, yeah, I'm thinking that, you know, here the thing is that H has two labels on it.
Right, but V is a fixed, SO42 we're doing, so there are 15 generators. So V is a 15 vector. I'm sorry. yeah, it's a fixed vector. V is a fixed vector.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so that's the first representation.
Right.
It's simpler to show covariance. I'll show covariance, you know, in the time we've got left for this case. For this one, it takes a little more work if you have that commutator. You've got to sort of do twice as much work. It does sort out. You can carry out the same proofs of linearity and Leibniz and covariance. But the other thing, you know, we're going to get Leibniz, the Leibniz property and covariance more or less by definition. Right, we're gonna define how we implement the covariant derivative by demanding that the Leibniz rule hold, and we're going to make sure it's covariant by defining how H transforms. So H transforms in a way that makes it covariant,
And V is applied to higher ranked tensors in a way that makes it Leibniz. And linearity just falls out immediately. So let's prove these things. Any questions before we start?
But wait, H are the dual one forms?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
I don't think I had V in definition, but I'm not sure.
Well, it depends what you're acting on. You know, it's that's probably why that's working,
okay.
Right? Because you've got a two-index thing. You know, if you think of omega as H summed on G, then you have the right two things acting on your
okay.
Logic. So what you've written, that omega AG is probably this whole thing.
Okay.
And then that index runs 1 through 6. It's the little a and b do.
Okay.
That's what's going on. And, you know, it could be, you know, there's also, all right, the spin connection is, well, the algebra valued one form, which we sum on generators, which, as it happens, we write with two labels. And, you know, they act on, some, like, say, 10 vectors or something. So, you know, you've written these indices, but there may be a sum on a double index inside of that, too.
Okay.
So, you know, probably, you know, that's what we were thinking of when we were talking about it before.
Okay.
But we just weren't remembering to think of it.
Okay. Okay.
All right. So let's prove some of these things. So our proof is going to be a little backhanded because you know we're getting two thirds of it by definition. Didn't we have
yes. Yes.
So linearity. We want B to act on. All right, so let's take complex numbers. We're working with complex vector spaces, so we can multiply by some complex scalars, and we've got say a linear combination of two vectors. And what do we get here? Well, that's the exterior derivative of that. What am I doing? Same index, different symbol. There we go. Linear combination plus our gauge field that knows how to act on that. Now I'll ask you to think about what that object is. So how have I defined H A B?
Very carefully.
What is it? It just sort of has to be over there. Right? It's an H summed on the generators.
Oh, okay.
Where the generators have little A, little B matrix structure.
So, it's still a one form.
It's still a one form, yes. So I'm still hiding the degree thing there. Okay, so equals what? Well, alpha and beta are constants. So we get alpha dVA plus beta dWA. No problem there with linearity. Here, alpha and beta are constants, so no problem here with linearity. H is a linear operator, acts on the vector space. So we just multiply it out, then we reconnect. We've got alpha dVA plus HAD dB and beta dWA plus HAB WB plus Markov-Jaffe score. That's alpha times the covariance exterior derivative of V plus theta times the covariant exterior derivative of W.
So linearity is easy. No problem here. Now, the Leibniz property when we have D as a Leibniz property, well, we have to be taking the product of fields. So we have to be differentiating like a second rank tensor or something before it's even relevant. So we have to ask what we define the derivative of some second rank thing to be. How do we define that? Well, let's just go mindlessly through this and see what happens. Right? We take the exterior derivative of those, and we know that Leibniz. You know, that's just an ordinary derivative. But now what happens? We have an H, and, you know, we have V, and we have W, and we don't necessarily know what to do. Well, you've learned the rule in general relativity. You slap one of those Christoffel symbols on each index. This is the reason. It won't be Leibniz if you don't. If you have an abelian group, you're still going to need a couple. What do you do there? Well, you have to assign weights to things. So, like a conformal weight, right? And it has to be additive. So, if this has conformal weight 2 and that has conformal weight 3, you assign a conformal weight of 5 and you stick a 5 here. That 5 is 2 plus 3, and you can break it into the Leibniz pieces. So, you have to have either an additive weight, or you have to put one connection form on each free index. That's the only way to make it like. So I claim only if one H on each index. And I'll say index or weight, using the term loosely. I work both out in the notes. So you can read through those. All right, if you have an abelian group, then there's no structure constant, so, you know, like, you don't have that commutator term. But there's an additive term that's just multiplicative on the field that you do have for the adjunct representation. So what we write here is we let H act on V multiplied by WV, and then we let H act on W, giving the B index back. And you can see immediately that that's exactly what it takes to make it Leibniz. So here we have D, VA plus the first term, HAC, BC, times WB, plus, and then when the D hits the W, we have a V out front here. Here we have a V out front, and we have DW plus HBC, WC, the composer, not the. And this is the covariant exterior derivative of V times W. And that is the times the covariant exterior derivative of W. So we have the Leibniz property, and as I say, you see that it holds if and only if we have both of these terms. It wouldn't be treating the indices in any symmetric sort of way if we didn't. I mean, there'd be all sorts of weirdness. But this is the way we get the Leibniz property. And we can do this for every higher rank tensor. The other thing to remember is that any tensor of rank k can be written as a sum of outer products of k vectors. So you take as many vectors as you like, take as many terms in the sum as you need to form an arbitrary tensor, but you can do it. You know, you pick, you know, 92 different vectors, no problem. The claim holds that I take outer products of k of them, I add as many of those as I need, and I can construct any rank k tensor. The fact that you can do that together with linearity and Leibniz properties
immediately shows that you differentiate a rank K tensor in the same way. You're still going to put one H on each index, because that's what you would do in each of those separate terms that's a product of K vectors. You know how to do K vectors because of this property. You know, you could bring a third vector in here and you could do an inductive proof that you, for a product of K vectors. You do the same thing in there are K terms here. Okay, then you argue, because she just read it out, that any tensor can be written as a sum of such things. You invoke linearity, and you prove that the covariant derivative of any tensor is just a bit. I think I gave that some exercise. So, you know, on any of these exercises, you know, if I say prove it for an arbitrary rank tensor, you know, if you want to, you know, fuss with it until you can convince yourself that you can do it for three, cool. do whatever. You know, or if you want to get practice at an inductive proof, just do the inductive proof. It's not actually that hard. I just taught you to. So, this is what makes it covariant. Let's see. I forget what happened. Let's see, with these commutators, if you have a product in these commutators, that commutator is already a derivation. So if I had a commutator of H with a product, remember, let me make a note here. In the adjoint case, I have a commutator of the outer product of B and W with H. That's B times the commutator of W with H, plus the commutator of B with H times W. It's already Lagrangian. So you get it for free here. That makes one think that you really ought to define the things using the adjoint representation. It's sort of nice. The problem is the proof of covariance is sort of messy there. On the other hand, the proof of covariance in the adjoint case makes it really clear the difference between an abelian and a non-abelian group. Because in the abelian case, these commutators vanish. So you have to add just B times H out here times the weight. So like the Weyl covariant derivative in Bayes-Marmol space, you know, we've done that before. That's exactly what happens. You just have a one-dimensional Lie group, so it's abelian. You don't have a commutator, so even in the adjoint representation, you're just going to add B times H or H times B, whichever, you know, as that one convention. And there it doesn't matter. They can get it anyway. Notice that if your fields happen also to be differential forms, that you have to worry about ordering and signs. So you should go back to the definitions and, all right, now suppose it's a one form. Well, you know, where am I going to get a sign difference? So you know what it is for vectors in the group. And that exterior derivative knows about differential forms, and so you'll pick up signs from that. But it's not actually too hard to figure out where you need the signs. So the covariant exterior derivative of an SUN valued one form may very well have a minus sign in it somewhere. It depends which side you write H on. Right? You know, if you wrote H with ellipses the other way and let it act from the right, then you would not be interchanging forms in situations where you would be on the other side. So your conventions make a difference. That's what happens. And if you're doing supersymmetries or you're doing anti-commuting numbers, it's even worse. But it's fine. Okay, we're to covariance. How do we get covariance? Get over here. Questions on any of this? All right.
need D prime of D prime to be D of V prime. Where this means, right, D prime of some vector, right? D is just an exterior derivative. Nothing happens to that, but the connection form changes. So we have some new connection form acting on W. So this is the part that's different in D prime. V prime is just a group element acting on V. Okay. How do we know that?
Define it.
V is the defining representation. The group acts linearly on a vector space, V.
Right.
Okay, so these are your defining tensors for the whole thing. So we better have linear homogeneous transformation there. And now we can, we know what this is. This prime just means G times that thing. Right, so what we want is for the derivative of some tensor to transform in exactly the same way as the tensor. So we want these two, those two things to transform the same way. So if we had a higher rank tensor, you'd have multiple G's here, just like in relativity. You put a transformation matrix on each index, well, then this would transform at the rank K tensor as well.
H prime is what, again?
H prime?
What is H prime?
We're going to derive it.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Yes.
We're back-ended proof. We're gaining covariance by definition. This will be how we define the transformation property of H. So we demand this and define that. So let's just work out what has to happen. We have D prime of V. So this primary condition is D of GV plus H prime AV acting on GDV, whatever that is. Now, this is a place where it's kind of fun to leap off all the indices. Let's not do that again. So what we want to get here is G, and then D, V, plus H, G. That's the covariant derivative without any indices. Let's see. That whole thing should have a free A. So I have G of GV is DG times V plus GDV. Then this is H prime GV equals GDV plus GHV. And this term always cancels. So let's bring the H prime to one side of the equation and everything else to the other side, G H V minus D G Now what I want to do is we're just right there. This has to be true for all of V, so it has to hold as an operator equation. Right? This holds for any vector V, so we have to have H G equal to G H minus D G. And now multiplying on the right by G inverse, we have H prime is G H G inverse minus D G G inverse. And that's how H has to transform. Now, there's a a point here where if your algebra, if you're doing this in the adjoint representation, so that you have a commutator over here, you know, these things reassemble into commutators, so that all works out right. But again, if the group is a billion, this point of stripping off D, doesn't work for an abelian vector. If the group isn't a simple group that has some stuff that commutes with everything, you're only going to get this operator relationship up to something that commutes with everything. And that's that additive term that you need in the abelian case. But, we're out of time, and this is where I wanted to get to. So, just take questions.
Why are we switching back and forth between the adjoint representation and
the answer question? I had not intended to present the adjoint representation. You know, the other representation is a lot simpler. So
what are the advantages then?
Well, if this was a commutator, you'd have an extra term, and you'd have to work everything through with, roughly twice as many terms. It would still work. It still works, and it's a good exercise. you get the Leibniz properly automatically with the commutator, and that works.